You're now plugged in to the Delphi podcast.
Hey everyone, it's your host Tommy, and I just hopped off a podcast with Caitlin Long, the founder and CEO of Custodia Bank. Caitlin is a 22-year Wall Street vet who's probably one of the most passionate guests we've ever had on. In this episode, Caitlin dives into the current regional banking crisis. We take this example to its extremes, discussing the importance of deposit-only banks where money is not lent out, which would help prevent bank runs and massive markdowns, which then require bailouts in bad times. Caitlin also covers why she thinks the government has unfairly blocked these banks from being put forward and what sort of audits we might see from internal and external auditors and paths forward. Later in the conversation, we discuss the outlook for the US dollar and draw comparisons to Caitlin's favorite book and one I'm currently reading called When Money Dies, The Nightmare of Deficit Spending, Deflation, and Hyperinflation in Weimar Germany. I want to give a special thanks to my partner Kevin Kelly and Jason P., who is a markets analyst, both at Delphi, for their questions and help in planning this episode. With that, let's dive into the episode. Caitlin, how's it going?
Hey there. It's great. Interesting times. Thanks for having me on.
You've had quite the week or 2 weeks, right? Regional bank blow up and you're kind of in the middle of it or on the periphery of it.
Well, I guess we were kind of at the tip of the spear because it was pretty clear they chose to go after us first in what became a coordinated effort that has been ongoing since January 27th when the Custodia news came out of the Fed.
It's kind of crazy. A lot of people, I had Nick Carter on a couple of weeks ago for Operation Chokepoint 2.0, and at the time, a lot of people thought it wasn't a coordinated effort, but it sounds like from what you're saying, you're well in that camp.
Oh, absolutely. We knew it was because I have now started talking publicly a little bit about some of the things that we knew. I had hinted at the time, we had evidence. And one of the things that I shared recently publicly is that one of the pieces of evidence was that the Fed and or White House both, it turns out both were involved, had leaked to the press 2 days before Custodia was voted down by the Fed that the vote was preordained and that that is what would happen if we did not withdraw our application. But the interesting thing about the email that we have from the press, there were multiple major press organizations that were tipped off to the fact that the vote was coming. The interesting thing is that one of the emails that we have actually says, we're aware that the Fed and OCC charter applicants were all asked simultaneously within the previous 48 hours to withdraw their applications. So we knew, we had the smoking gun that there was coordination because it came from a reporter who was tipped off to it.
That's absolutely wild. I mean, so yeah. just to level set, so you run Custodia Bank, you founded it. You're a full suite, you offer a full suite of banking and financial services tailored to business customers for regulatory clarity to minimize transactional costs, the whole nine yards. So you're basically
running
we're not operating yet,
to be clear, but yes.
Got it. Okay.
That's the proposal. Yeah.
And why do you think it's so hard to get a crypto-friendly bank up? I mean, it seems like you're doing everything right.
Well, that was the idea. Go in through the front door, be very transparent. Ask for permission for everything we were doing and work with the regulators. And we've said publicly it was mainly to ensure that the two systems don't hurt each other, namely the traditional banking system and the digital asset system. These two things exist in parallel, and we don't want either one, at least I don't want either one to hurt the other. I know there are people in both camps who really do want to hurt the other. But I don't. I very much want both to be stable and allowed to thrive and have safe and compliant connectivity between the two.
Can you walk us through a bit of the amount of work or the gravity of the work that you've been through over the past, call it, I don't know how many years, in trying to set up a compliant crypto bank? I mean, I don't think people understand how much work went into this.
Oh, man. My average day was 18 hours beginning last summer through January. And I did take a day off finally at Christmas, but it was 7 days a week. It was It's just insanity how much work it is to set up a bank in this country. It is. Every little detail is regulated.
That's crazy. You know you're working hard when you could pick the one day where you took off. That's crazy. So, I mean, what are the options today? I mean, you know, assume I'm like dumb, I'm new to crypto, I need a bank account for payroll, to raise money, what have you. What are my options today? Just roll the dice with what banks are left, or what do people do?
Well, that's the irony that the regulators said they don't want banks to specialize, but that's what they're actually forcing. And it's a function of the way the Bank Secrecy Act and compliance requirements work, that banks have to specialize. If there's a high-risk industry that they're doing business with, let's say it's gaming, leave crypto out of it, or let's say it's adult entertainment, there's a lot of money laundering risk in those industries. And so what ends up happening is that the compliance departments become experts in those industries. And so you get a specialization of the compliance departments, and yet the regulators have come out and said, no, they don't want banks specializing. Well, it's a function of the realities of the compliance departments that they have to specialize. And so what the bank regulators are really saying is that they don't want the banks to service those industries at all.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, if you deny the banks that are specializing in crypto and you basically soft tell the major existing banks not to deal with crypto, nobody deals with crypto.
That's exactly what the idea it seems to be.
That's crazy. Jeez.
Yeah. Well, but you know what? To be fair, this is not new. This is Operation Choke Point 2.0. Nick Carter is not wrong. I think he definitely had the right and early read of the situation that the bank regulators were trying to repeat. And by the way, it's the same people. The head of the FDIC, Marty Gruenberg, was in one of the people who started Operation Choke Point 1.0. That started in 2011 with the debanking of the payday lenders. And it ended up expanding to 30 different industries before Congress got involved. And now they're back at it. And they started 2.0 with the crypto industry. And I don't think anybody should assume they're going to stop. Just like they went to 30 different industries in the first version, I think if you're the oil and gas industry, if you're the mining industry, if you're any sort of fossil fuels or cattle or firearms or any of those, you know, certainly the 30 industries that got targeted in 1.0 should be nervous. But anyone, especially related to the whole ESG thing, it should be nervous this time as well. They've been emboldened because they got away with it so far.
How much of this do you think is, like, I'm trying to figure out what this stems from. Like, I don't automatically assume people in the government are not objective or not smart, right? So I'm trying to figure out is there someone over the shoulder of these regulators and these people in the government saying, you know, hey, Caitlin Long's starting a bank, it's crypto, let's just auto deny this? Or do you think that they're taking a real methodical look at, you know, hey, there's fraud here, we don't like it? Like, I'm just really struggling to figure out why there is so much of a coordinated, like, cultural effort in the government to shoot this down.
Oh, well, it's broader than just crypto. There, if you look at the folks in the White House, it is acknowledged that they hired somebody who is an antitrust expert to break up big tech, who's part of this same group. So I've never met any of these people. I never had a seat at the table, and I suspect that was on purpose during the president's working group meetings. But long story short, there's a anti-crypto and anti-tech wing of the Biden administration, and they have taken the power for sure.
What is the point, though? Like, do they understand that they're thwarting, like, the next stage of technology and companies starting in the U.S., or are they trying to, like, overly protect the consumer? Like, what is their tagline? Like, what is the reason, do you think?
Well, they had good reason to crack down on the fraud in this industry, and I absolutely believe that government can and should defend private property rights when fraudsters attack private property. Okay, and that's what FTX did. That's what all these frauds that collapsed in a heap of ashes did, and they deserve to burn on a raging funeral pyre. I do not mince words about the bad actors in this industry. They deserve to be in jail. So they're not wrong in going after those. What's happened, though, is that because they recognize, I can't put words in their mouth, but it has been speculated, is maybe the good way to put it, that they recognize that this technology takes power away from them. And they fear it. They should not fear it. They should welcome the folks like us at Custodia who were at the table with them, were warning them of the problems months before the problems hit, and were trying hard to work with them, not in opposition to them. And the response that Custodia ultimately got from the Fed was nasty.
Yeah, no, it's kind of hard to think through, because I'm just trying to think through what would be the most conducive environment for Custodia to launch, right? And it sounds like you need a lot more education, potentially a regime change in the government. You need some pushback on the overreach. And some people would probably tell you, you know, hey, Caitlin, pack it up and do this in, you know, 2 to 5 years. But I don't even know if that makes sense, because nothing's going to change in 2 or 5 years if people like you aren't pushing back to educate everybody to move this forward, right? Then we just get overregulated and this doesn't exist anymore.
Well, that's certainly what they seem to be trying to do right now. Yes, regime change is going to be necessary, but let's step back and think about what are the levers that can be pulled against overreach from executive branch agencies. The legislative branch can push back. Well, Congress is pretty much impotent because it's a divided Congress. You've got the two houses in split GOP and Democratic hands, with the president in control, presidents in control of the Democrats, right? So pretty unlikely that anything's going to happen through the legislative branch. Well, our founding fathers, in their wisdom, had three equal branches of government. Okay, the judicial branch is absolutely a part of this. And it takes longer and the wheels of justice turn more slowly, but that is an equal branch of government. And when you have substantial executive branch overreach and the legislative branch can't address it, that is absolutely a remedy. There's more, though. The internal and external auditing functions of the government are also meaningful. I just before we started tweeted out, I didn't realize that on Saturday, Senator Warren sent a letter to the three inspectors general of the three federal banking agencies. The FDIC, I read in American Banker, has as a policy that with every FDIC receivership, the inspector general reviews the circumstances and the valuation of the assets. Okay, so that's effectively an internal auditing function that's automatic. So, and Senator Warren wrote to all three of them and asked for a preliminary report within 30 days. So those internal auditors, if they comply with her request, I don't know if they will, I don't know if they have to, I just don't know enough about it, but those internal auditors, inspectors general, who are law enforcement agents, who have subpoena power, who are independent, they are absolutely in a position of power to do something about this if there were overreach. And then the next question is the external auditors, the GAO, the Government Accountability Office. There have been there was a bipartisan call for the GAO to investigate all of this. And I think that's very fair. So you have both the agency's internal auditing functions and the external auditing functions that absolutely can and should and probably will be independent reviews. You know, it's so funny because the Fed doesn't want independence in its reviews, right? The Fed itself is really not audited. They like to, when they review, they come out and say they review themselves. So there was a press release saying that from Jerome Powell that he was going to have the Fed's head of supervision do the internal review at the Fed. Well, the Fed's head of supervision has been in his job since July. And guess what? He sits over the examiners who failed in the Silicon Valley Bank case, right? And so here you have the examiners examining themselves. The investigators investigating themselves. And moreover, the 2 days before Silicon Valley Bank collapsed, Powell was in front of Congress telling Congress that the financial system was stable. That looks particularly ill-timed. But more importantly, the person he put in charge of the investigation, i.e. the guy whose division had the regulatory failure, he, on the morning of the Silicon Valley Bank run, made a speech, an anti-crypto speech, incidentally, where he said, Fed-supervised banks don't have bank runs because they're subject to prudential supervision. I'm paraphrasing. Again, these are some of the worst timed statements ever by bank regulators. And so it's funny because the Fed is not bringing in an independent investigator. So when Elizabeth Warren is calling for its inspector general to look into this, you know, the FDIC's inspector general review is automatic. In the case of the Fed's, it doesn't appear to be. But I think that external pressure on these agencies to do a serious independent review is going to be heated, because the calls are bipartisan and they're absolutely fair. The bank regulators do not look good right now. Another tweet I just put out a few minutes before we started this was the FDIC. There's a Wall Street Journal editorial today about the statements made by Barney Frank with Signature Bank, where he said, look, we were a going concern. You look at the equity value of Signature Bank on the day before it was received, and it was $7 billion. So it does look like there may have been a taking of private property. Well, it turns out that the FDIC had a $2.5 billion hole, filled a $2.5 billion hole. There are legitimate questions being asked. Well, if they had sold SEN, Signet, it was the network that was used by crypto companies, would the FDIC insurance fund have had to cover a $2.5 billion hole? But on top of that, if they had waited one more day, then the Fed, the new facility, the BTFP facility, the new facility that the Fed put in place last week Sunday, that BTFP facility would have been available to Signature, and the FDIC insurance fund wouldn't have had to have eaten a $2.5 billion loss. Now, these banking agencies, from what I understand, we have a lot of ex-insiders who have worked, you know, in and around these agencies that work with us. And the agencies don't like each other. There's a rivalry between them. So I rhetorically asked the question, was there some shenanigans here where, you know, it was a hot potato, the FDIC didn't want to have to take the loss. If they'd waited a day, it would have been the Fed dealing with it, and there might not have been a loss. But instead, the Fed probably put pressure on the FDIC to take the loss. And instead of actually maximizing the value by selling the Signet network and the crypto deposits, of which there were $4 billion at Signature, it looks like the FDIC just ate a $2.5 billion hole. Now, all those things are allegations at this point. We don't know for sure. But here's the interesting thing. There is an automatic review, apparently, that is triggered by the Inspector General of the FDIC. And I think that those reports are going to be very, very interesting. And Elizabeth Warren, again, asked for preliminary reports within 30 days. She's in the majority in the Senate, in the Senate Banking Committee, very powerful. And we will see if there is an independent review and what it says, because I suspect that there were some interesting things that happened, and it's going to come out. It will eventually come out.
Caitlin, your passion and how much you follow everything going on is seriously unmatched. It's just awesome to listen to everything you're saying. And I mean, I don't know the details of everything you mentioned, but I think the broad stroke of what I'm understanding from what you're saying is that the Fed and banking regulators are a little drunk on power, moving pretty fast without a lot of oversight. And now you're going to start having these independent internal and external committees sort of looking at their actions and saying, hey, this was legit, hey, this wasn't. And then maybe potentially that's where you and others get some reprieve on review?
Well, it wouldn't be for Custodia. Custodia has nothing to do with the review that the inspectors general have been asked to provide by Senator Warren. She's not looking at the applicants. She's looking at the banks that actually failed. Although I think there definitely are people in Washington who want to look at the applicants as well. Again, the fact that we have that smoking gun email that said both the Fed and the OCC applicants were asked to withdraw their applications at the same time. Holy cow, that's a due process violation, folks. I mean, you know, these applications are supposed to stand on their own individual merits. And it is clear that they did not.
But I mean, if the review comes back positive for not the applicants like Custodia, but others, and it's favorable, that would make for a more favorable environment for Custodia, I think, right?
I mean, maybe. Well, you know, we'll have to see. It's going to be fascinating to see how this all plays out. Because I think it's crystal clear that I know there has been substantial regulatory overreach by the bank regulators in Washington, D.C. And as an example, I'll point to one very clear one. On January 27th, at the same time that Custodia's application denial came out, which, by the way, happened lightning fast on a vote that morning. And by the way, a reporter had the story 4 minutes after we were notified. Okay, so obviously, you know, leaks all over the place in violation of confidentiality requirements, etc. But the Fed announced a new policy statement, and here's the issue. That policy statement was a major change in policy. The Administrative Procedure Act requires that federal agencies, of which the Federal Reserve Board of Governors is one, must put out major policy changes for public comment. And it must, by law, each agency must, by law, take into account those public comments. Okay? The Fed did not do that. And they published it as final in the Federal Register on February 7th. No public comment. And published in the Federal Register less than 2 weeks later as final. These are issues. There are violations of legal requirements here. And this is where I think a GAO investigation into all of this and potentially judicial branch review of all of this is where the remedies lie right now, given that Congress is not likely to overturn these.
Caitlin, so we're pretty focused right now on banking and crypto, and I think it's well known how inefficient our government is in the U.S. How many of this, or how much of these issues or frustrations that you have are specific to, I don't know, crypto and banking, right? I mean, I feel like the government overall is insanely inefficient, and I know that we're zeroed in on crypto, but is this a crypto issue, or is this just the government itself is inefficient everywhere, so maybe we're casting too broad a stroke on their overreach into crypto? I'm not sure if this is the best question, but maybe you know where I'm going with it.
It's an overreach across the board. Absolutely, it's an overreach across the board.
Yeah. So, switching gears a little bit, I mean, just to switch to the banking structure itself, there, Lynn Alden mentioned that in the past, a bank tried to keep 100% of their deposits in cash, but the idea was shot down by the government because it would seem that this would siphon off a lot of capital that would be lent out and keep our economic engine running. But it seems like, you know, people are starting to catch wind of the idea, you know, why can't we have a bank that doesn't lend out all of its money and, you know, have these duration mismatch issues which caused the crash?
Correct. A lot of people are catching on. There was an incredible article written by a Harvard Law School professor in the Harvard Business Press on Friday saying, hey, if we had payment banks, all of these businesses who had their payroll at risk, because most, let's face it, if you've got more than, you know, 15 employees, your payroll payment is going to be more than $250,000, give or take, right? I mean, even if you're a small business that happens to be in a very highly compensated industry, your payroll is going to be more than $250,000. Okay, so if you keep more than $250,000 in your bank account to pay payroll, you're at risk of your bank failing while your payroll payment is in flight. Okay, these are problems. These are serious problems. And that's what this article was saying, that we need payment banks that are not lending banks. Well, this author clearly didn't know that those banks have already been proposed. This is not new. They have been, there are a number of states that have uninsured bank charter laws that predate the FDIC, which was a Depression era, I think 1933 program. And so, obviously the United States is a lot older than 1933, right? And so a lot of states that had banking charters on their books before 1933 had uninsured charters. Every state that had a banking charter in its on its laws before 1933 was uninsured by definition. And so a number of New England states have these uninsured bank charters. And then more recently, Wyoming and Nebraska have enacted them. The Fed keeps blocking them. And that is the crux of the issue. The Fed is the one blocking these special payment banks. And the question legally is, do they have the right to do so? That is the subject of multiple lawsuits.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I mean, like, let's walk down that path a little bit. If a bank were to operate without lending out capital, who do you think would take on the role of lending capital to businesses? Because if it's no longer the bank, would that then be the government?
No. See, here's the thing. If we could start over again and create a financial system that was stable, we would have these 100% non-reserve, non-lending banks that would handle payments, and they would not pay interest, most likely. And then you have lending banks that do pay interest. And those basically are organizations where you know you're putting your capital at risk, and you as a depositor get a return on the from the loan portfolio's yield. And you know that if those loans default, you might lose your capital. It's crystal clear. Right now, we've married those two things, right? You have the depository that holds your cash and the lender that lends your cash in the same roof, and they're using the same cash. That is ultimately why the banks are unstable, because the basic business model of a bank in the United States right now presumes that people don't all withdraw their funds at the same time. If everyone withdraws their funds at the same time, the bank has a liquidity crisis. Bank runs are not a problem for a bank that has 100% cash, but because these banks have gone and lent out their customers' funds, it's the old It's a Wonderful Life, right? Or it's the Bart Simpson, you know, figuring out that his money is in, you know, Joe's house, right? And then he goes and smacks Joe. You know, that's the way banks work, folks. It is amazing how few people realize that. And in the article that I just posted on my personal blog last night makes the analogy to Uber drivers, right? If you parked your car at a valet garage while you went to dinner, and you came back and realized that the garage rented out your car to an Uber driver and pocketed all the money, you'd be angry. And you'd especially be angry if the Uber driver crashed your car, because you'd have an unexpected financial loss. Okay, I just laid out for you how banking works. The bank takes your money and proverbially rents it out to an Uber driver. You have all the risk, whether you know it or not, except for the insurance up to $250,000, but I'll come back to that in a moment. And then if the Uber driver crashed your car, i.e. the bank goes under, you have an unexpected financial loss. Folks, that's the way banking has worked in this country for a century. It's amazing how few people understand how unstable the system is, because it rests on a collective illusion of security, when if everyone withdraws their money at the same time, there isn't a single bank in the United States, the biggest ones included, that could survive that. So, however, let's talk about FDIC insurance, because naturally everyone assumes, well, wait a minute, my bank deposits are insured. And that is indeed the case for most bank deposits, the up to $250,000. So the vast majority of accounts are below $250,000. And it's a little over half of the bank deposits in the United States. There's $17.8 trillion of bank deposits in the banking industry, of which about $10 trillion are insured. Okay, so, but these are big numbers. Now, here's the wowzer number. The wowzer number is the FDIC insurance fund has $128.2 billion. Again, there's $17.6 billion of bank deposits, and the FDIC insurance fund has $128 billion.
Jesus.
Exactly. It doesn't even cover a percent of the bank deposits.
But Caitlin, I mean, if you have, and your blog post is great, I'll link to it in the show notes. But if you have boring banks, you know, one idea is that, hey, they make fees instead of interest margin, whatever. That's not the super important point here. But if you had boring banks where all of the capital was stored, I guess two questions for you. Obviously, you could never have a bank run, So you don't have to have these issues with the Fed bailing banks out. But you also, why do you even need FDIC insurance? I mean, all the money's there.
You don't. That's the point. You could have a bank run, but the bank would survive the bank run no problem because it would pay out all the depositors as they want their deposits. And the practical reality is if everybody understood that was how their bank worked, you wouldn't ever really likely have a crisis of confidence. So you probably wouldn't have a bank run because everyone would know that if they could get their cash out, they would. So, or if they wanted to get their cash out, they could rather. So that's the difference of a 100% reserve bank that it doesn't need insurance. The insurance is actually not, the numbers I just gave you are staggering, right? The FDIC insurance fund covers less than 1% of the total deposits in the banking industry. So if we have a systemic crisis, the FDIC isn't going to cover your bank deposits, folks. It's simple math. But the point is, if you had a 100% reserve bank that wasn't lending and was sitting on cash, then that's better than FDIC insurance. That's exactly the point.
That's crazy. And I mean, to switch gears a little bit to who would back and fund these boring banks, I mean, sure, earning fees sounds like on the onset a little less interesting than earning a margin or lending out the money and earning a spread. But you also don't have the risk that your regional bank stock is going to zero, like what we've seen in the past couple of weeks.
Correct. Yeah, correct. But so when you ask who would fund a bank like that, look at all the shareholders who invested in Custodia, because that's exactly what Custodia is. It's a bank that's designed to be a 100% reserve bank that just sits in cash in a Fed master account. That was our proposal. Of course, it was not approved, but obviously we're still alive. But the point is that there were a lot of people who invested in that. When that's the bank's business model, the bank has to find other ways to earn fee income. And in our case, our proposal was and still is. This was approved, by the Wyoming Division of Banking, when we got our bank charter and our certificate of authority to operate. Our proposal was to be a custody bank as well, to provide custody services for digital assets, just like the Fed approved for Bank of New York Mellon.
So, Caitlin, let me play devil's advocate. So if I'm depositing to a bank like Custodia, it's really great that I know that my money's always there. I don't have a risk on, you know, having to tap into FDIC insurance, which might not cover it. But looking at the government's actions and then backstopping like all the deposits anyway, is it still worth going and depositing into a Custodia bank if I know the government's just going to backstop me forever anyway? I think I might be a little confused there, but...
No, well, here's the thing. Look at the math. $17.6 billion of total bank deposits. The U.S. GDP is $23 trillion. If you strip out government spending, that's $17.6 trillion of commercial bank deposits is greater than the private GDP in the United States. Okay, what? Can we put another $17 trillion of debt on the federal government's balance sheet? That's a rhetorical question because I think we all know the answer to that.
No, me too. I mean, to close out this conversation loop or just this point, where would banks lose that $18 trillion? Is this just duration mismatch, rates up, bonds lower, massive losses government has to cover? Or like, where would that... Because, I mean, it's not all invested in VC funds around, you know, Silicon Valley.
Right. Well, no, here's the thing. Where does money go in a bank run? It goes into securities. It goes into real estate. It goes into digital assets. It goes into precious metals. It goes into both financial assets outside of the banking system and into hard assets that are non-financial assets, jewelry, collectibles, right? And I'm sure a lot of people who withdrew their funds in the last several weeks didn't put them necessarily into other banks. They probably put them into T-bills or into securities or, you know, money market funds, right? They wanted out of the banking system in its entirety, I suspect. We don't know. We'll have to look at the fund flows when they come out.
So I'm reading the When Money Dies book. It's the nightmare story of the hyperinflation in Germany. And so let's keep going with your example. So let's say we have a crazy recession. Let's take it a step further and say depression. let's say the value of the assets that the bank invested in, real estate, stocks, whatever you want to call them, jewelry, doesn't matter, starts to fall. The government has to cover, you know, trillions in deposits. That's when we get into a situation where we're just hyperinflating our economy. And I guess maybe this is Balaji's thesis, but I'm not exactly sure on his specifics.
Yeah. Well, I'm not someone who thinks hyperinflation is going to happen tomorrow. I acknowledge it could. There's so much debt in this system right now, and the system is fundamentally unstable. But just because folks realize it's fundamentally unstable doesn't mean that it wasn't fundamentally unstable 3 weeks ago before all this started, you know, broke into people's consciousness, right? So just because it's now, I guess when you say it's a confidence game and collectively more people are starting to realize, the math doesn't work, and lose confidence in the system, so they're looking for exit ramps, it does make things a little more serious. But the point is, the solvency issue at the core of the system is not new. Anyone who has studied this has known about it for quite some time.
No, it's crazy to think through, because I always just naively assumed that the deposits in the bank were in safer securities than what they are in. So yeah, it's crazy to think through. How serious do you think that the recent regional bank crisis will get? I mean, it seems to be escalating from Silvergate to Signature, First Republic, now Credit Suisse, which is hilarious or just really disastrous in how they're undoing property rights to approve that merger. But I guess that's another story. But yeah, can you give us some color on how bad you think that the crisis actually is versus what we're seeing on Twitter?
It's pretty bad. And the piece of evidence that I have to support that is that I saw yesterday 129 banks that have asked the Fed to be covered, basically to have all their deposits guaranteed. So far only a few banks have failed. And by the way, I don't know when the United States got to the view that no bank should ever fail. If you look at the history of bank failures, banks were failing right and left throughout most of human history, right? We don't want banks never to fail, because when the banks never fail, what they do is basically, it's like the Nassim Taleb, you know, you should let forest fires burn, because if you don't, then all of this, you know, dead stuff accumulates on the floor of the forest, so that when it does light on fire, it's an absolute conflagration. And in a true free market, we would have failures. So the whole notion that we should never have a bank failure, and that three bank failures are just, you know, mean the sky's falling down, that's crazy. It used to be that dozens and dozens of banks failed in the United States each year, and that was no big deal. But now, unfortunately, because they're so leveraged and they're so overregulated, the conflagration, the proverbial conflagration, could actually be starting. So the honest truth is, no one knows what the financial system is going to look like on the other side of whatever we're facing right now. It does look like we have a banking crisis. It does look like there are solvency issues in the community and regional banks, especially, that did not hedge their interest rate risk and are sitting on big unrealized losses in their bond portfolios and their loan portfolios, just simply by nature of the fact that interest rates went up and they didn't have that rate exposure hedged. And so if you mark to market their portfolios, their equity's gone in a lot of cases. And those that had access, you know, this is the government picking winners, right? Those that had more securities have access to the new BTFP facility. Those that have more loans can't bring those to the Fed for liquidity. And therefore, you see, this is one of the reasons why First Republic stock has gotten hit so hard. It had more loans and fewer securities on its books. Okay, so the fact that their stock is getting hit so hard, while the other regional banks that had similar financial metrics, but they invested in securities instead of loans, well, they can take those securities to the Fed's BTFP program and get liquidity for those at par, even though they might be trading at 60 or 70 cents on the dollar. The Fed just turned itself into a leveraged lender through the BTFP facility. That is new. The Fed's never done that before. But you see, like, the the whack-a-mole game that the Fed is having to play here, just to keep the system afloat.
And, it's crazy,
and
too.
More and more people are figuring this out. Yeah.
I mean, they extended it to international banks as well, or maybe not
Correct.
International banks, but what was the reason for that? Because if those banks start mass selling their assets, it creates dysfunction.
Correct.
Got it.
Correct. And to be honest, the other piece is that the U.S. dollar market is global, and we saw this in 2008. The Fed's balance sheet went from 800 billion ish to 3 trillion in 2008. It reached as high as 10-ish trillion this time, but back then, 800 billion to 3 trillion, the bulk of that balance sheet expansion, if you go back and look at the post-mortem analysis by the Bank for International Settlements that traced the fund flows, the bulk of that expansion of that Fed balance sheet expansion back then went to foreign banks. And I think the same is going to be true here.
I mean, I'm not exactly against equity holders in a bank getting wiped out for overextending, are you?
Right. No, of course not. Absolutely. That's exactly my point.
Yeah.
In a free market, of course you'd have businesses fail. The whole concept that we don't have businesses fail, it just confirms to you that this is not a free market.
I'm not smart enough or haven't spent enough time to realize the downstream impacts, but it sounds like if you're not able to let anything fail, the Fed just accrues all of this horrible bad debt and you just can't dig yourself out of it at some point.
Well, that's the case for the dollar bears. I would warn the dollar bears, though, as you're reading the book, When Money Dies, is one of my favorite books. The amplitude and the frequency of huge swings in markets increases as the currency dies. And you had 50% intraday moves in the mark versus the franc and in the mark versus gold back then, before Germany hit hyperinflation. And we're going to see that kind of stuff. We're not there yet. So I would be careful that the dollar bears, there's a huge short position in the U.S. dollar, and there's going to be an incredible head fake short covering rally in the U.S. dollar. And it won't have anything to do with the fundamentals. Just beware of that.
The crazy part about that book, I'd love to have a whole episode on it. I mean, once the Reparations Committee even visited Germany, or it might have been Austria earlier in the book, the mark would just automatically devalue even more just when they showed up. It was
back then everybody was out for blood, right? And you know, there's an interesting lesson to be discussed there.
Yeah, I mean, they did have a large external outlay though, right? Like they had to pay for a literal war. Us, on the other hand, in the U.S., I mean, I'm not sure what our outlay is, right? Is it basically, maybe it's just covering the banks in this comparison?
Well, we are in war. That's something else that a lot of folks haven't talked about. We are in war. Look at all the money that's being spent on Ukraine right now. We're in a wartime economy, and wars are inherently inflationary.
So, Caitlin, why would you tell people, and I mean, not financial advice ever from me or you, but what would be your bearish view on why not to go to crypto in what is seemingly like a very inflationary environment?
Well, I don't make investment recommendations. Everybody's situation is different. So just, you know, do your homework, read the book When Money Dies and start learning the history, because history does rhyme, and, start putting yourself in those positions and understanding the real world, real day-to-day decisions people had to make, because you start then making your own judgments for yourself and your family. What's the right thing for you to do? Everybody's situation is different based on, based on the where they are in their lives, where they are in their careers. Can they pick up and move? Are there, how many dependents do you have in terms of your children and or your parents? And your spouse, and those kinds of questions are very different for different people, which is why the answer is very different for different people.
Caitlin, I'm glad we're talking about this book, because it's scaring me and informing me at the same time. It's impossible to predict, but and I'm sure it'll be sadly worse in other countries than the U.S. But how bad do you think the U.S. could get compared to what happened in Germany? Like, do you think it's too sensationalist to say something similar can happen?
Oh, look, no, there's no question that fiat currencies have a limited lifespan. So what I hope is that, you know, if you look, of course, Britain had to, there were two world wars fought as pound sterling was handing the baton from it to the U.S. dollar as global reserve currency. But there were a couple decades where you essentially had two reserve currencies, the pound sterling as it was essentially no longer a currency of global trade, and then to the U.S. And the U.S. had a huge balance sheet back then, had huge surpluses. Now we're a debtor nation, very different. But my point is that you did not see the total collapse of British society. Now, some would argue, when it was handing the baton to the U.S., some would argue that the war overshadowed all of that. And that caused the collapse, and that really was the collapse of British society as it was losing its reserve currency status. And I sure hope that doesn't happen here in the United States as well. But the most important point I'm trying to make is fiat currencies don't necessarily end with a bang. They might end with a whimper. And from a societal stability perspective, you'd prefer that they end with a whimper. And arguably, that's what happened with pound sterling.
Caitlin, last question for you because we're running low on time. But let's say that you and I, or I'll just put myself in this camp because I'm not sure your views specifically, but let's say that we are right and that, I'm right. Crypto goes to the moon and we're still in the US. Do we even win, right? Because wouldn't the government just come after all of it anyway and say, look, guys, you know, you guys have made all this money. We actually need it to support our economy.
Well, they'll try, right? And look at Biden's budget. It's dead on arrival, but he is proposing that capital gains are taxed, but capital losses cannot be written off. That's the same way, by the way, residential real estate works. Capital gains are taxed, but if you lose money selling your home, then you eat it. It's not recoverable. So they're already working on those kinds of things. But, you know, I think it's interesting that they know they can't ban Bitcoin. Can they go after pretty much everything else under the guise that it's a security? There's certainly an argument. I think there's a big debate with Ethereum, but there's certainly an argument, especially when it switched to proof of stake. We don't know definitively, and the U.S. government has not given us the answer. Is Ethereum a security? We don't know for sure, but we do know that they have said that Bitcoin is a commodity. So that's the one that we have some insight into, and it means that the attack vector from that perspective on Bitcoin is smaller. The attack surface is smaller.
Yeah, I was just reading Paul Grewal's from the CLO at Coinbase, his letter to the SEC on why Ethereum doesn't pass the Howey test. And I thought it was interesting to see their pushback. But Caitlin, just to close out, how can people support, you know, you and other leaders, right? Like the Brian Armstrongs of the world, the Jeremy Allaires, the Caitlin Longs, like how do we support you and your efforts?
Be very loud. I mean, now's the time, seriously, to be very, very loud. I think that's the most important thing. And some folks have asked about financially helping us. Stay tuned.
Would love to have some donate button that goes to you and all the communities trying to help push things forward. But Caitlin, I know you have to hop. Thank you so much for coming on. Your passion is outrageously strong, and this was a lot of fun.
Much appreciated. Thank you.